This is Solo Travel Talk, the Japan series. Your solo travel advisor and host is Astrid Clements.
There are so many things to do, see, experience, and eat in Japan, and your solo travel advisor, Astrid Clements, used her time to the fullest on her recent Asian adventure. You know that Astrid is a pro at creating an itinerary and maxing out her experience no matter where she goes. I'm producer Catherine O'Brien. To help you prepare for a trip to Japan, Astrid has collected her top 10 must-dos. Prepare yourself for just the right mix of beauty, culture, cuisine, and adventure in wonderful Japan. And Astrid, we are going to be having a nice how-to in the middle of the show. We know that our listeners love your how-tos, so we've decided for this Japan series that we are going to build in a how-to on each of the episodes.
Right. On this one, we're going to be talking about, or I'm going to give you a few tips on how I go about building itineraries, because especially when you travel to a place like Japan, an itinerary is very important. And there are some big challenges with having an itinerary. So I want to talk a little bit about that.
That'll be good. So we'll be having that in the middle of the show. But let's get started about your must-dos for Japan. I just got to know, you're such a pro, like I mentioned, at creating itineraries. Was it hard for you to set your itinerary before your Japan trip?
Well, I have to answer that yes and no. I mean, number one, I never traveled to Japan. And when I started doing all my pre-trip research, it was really, I found it difficult to prioritize because, you know, I saw a lot of things. You know, number one, there are a whole lot of different temples and shrines in Japan. And it's very difficult to discern which one you want to go to. Like in Kyoto, they have over 17 UNESCO World Heritage Sites, of which I think about 8 of those are temples and shrines. Hmm. And these are outstanding places to visit. So it's really hard when you're reading, you know, about the different things in the different cities and in reference to temples and shrines specifically, which ones should you do? Because after a certain amount, you tend to not be as in tune to what you're doing. So you don't want to do too much of the same type of activity. So that's one challenge. The other one is basically there's a lot of stuff that I wanted to do that not a lot of people might want to do, et cetera, like go to some museums that are a little bit different, as well as, you know, I went to the textile center, or I wanted to, in Kyoto to watch them weave the beautiful kimono fabrics. They do a kimono style show, and they have the most wonderful gift shop in that textile center, because everything is totally authentic Japanese, and you can buy anything there that, you know, is fabric oriented, I guess you would say, for the most part, and it's just beautiful. And they have a museum in there, etc. And not I don't know how many people really would take the time to do that, but I did, and I loved it. So, you know, when I'm doing an itinerary and for Japan, somewhere I've never gone before, you know, I'm looking at what are the must-dos that I'm reading about, all the things that I want to do. That's a little off the beaten path, I guess you would say. But I really always start with just making a big list. I know I key in on where the destinations will be, and then I figure out basically how long I think the trip should be in terms of cost and in terms of what I want to do. And in my Japan trip, it ended up being 3.5 weeks. I went to 2 major metropolitan cities, Tokyo, of course, and Osaka. Then I went to 2 traditional places. One was Kyoto, and then Nara, where Japan or Imperial Japan really started. I went to the Hakone mountainous areas, which is famous for, you know, the gorgeous nature and forest and lakes and little villages. There's all kinds of things in the Hakone Mountains that are just magical. And then last, to Hiroshima. I particularly wanted to go to Hiroshima. So that's where I went. So, or that's where I decided that I was going to go. Then from these six places, I wanted to basically really experience the Japanese way of life, culture. I wanted to get a good understanding of the history, of their spiritual beliefs, their aesthetics, you know, their architecture and how it evolved from ancient times to you know, kind of samurai times and then modern times. As well as I wanted to have some time to experience the fashion scene, to window shop, to shop myself, because the Japanese aesthetics and fashion are wonderful. They are so quality oriented. They're simplistic, but they have beautiful flowing lines. And I find their fashions are just super for contemporary life and really good for travel. So, you know, that was important to me. Then the food. I mean, you know, I was very determined to go, you know, and try everything. Sushi, sukiyaki, kaseki meals, udon noodles, you know, what's the other noodle? Ramen noodles. I mean, they got so many ramen noodle bowls. I mean, just everything about eating and enjoying Japanese cuisine. So I'm not a big foodie, but in Japan, I did focus on cuisine.
Shout out to our episode totally on the food that you enjoyed in Japan. That was a delicious episode.
Oh, yeah. My well, we're doing a series on Japan. We've taken the Solo Travel Talk from a weekly broadcast to a seasonal format where we really want to focus on a particular topic or a particular country and kind of give you an in-depth view of a lot of different things that I think is important, as well as a lot of how-to tips, and just help you kind of formulate in your mind how to execute a trip there, you know, what you want to see and decide whether you even want to go there. So but, you know, that's so tune into the food episode, because I go into all kinds of things that you would never think about or know about Japanese food. And then also, I really wanted to understand the Japanese spiritual beliefs, because I had read quite a bit about Shintoism and then also Buddhism, and how it's a little bit different than Buddhism in other areas of the world. And especially the Zen factor. You know, in Japan, I mean, these people are so focused and so disciplined, and they work very hard, but they just seem to be able to have a flow about their life. And they just seem to really be able to be really busy and get everything done and not stressed out, bottom line. I mean, they just know how to keep in balance. And they're very warm. And like I said, they're friendly. And I just found it mystifying being an American or a citizen of the West. And we tend to get stressed out, and little things, you know, become big things when they shouldn't. The Japanese, I don't know that. So I was really interested in kind of understanding what's at the bottom of all of this. And so I wanted the itinerary or the must-dos. I was thinking I want to hit all these parameters. So, when I'm through, I have made up my own mind on what I have experienced. Then I really wanted to, the last thing is I wanted opportunities to interact with Japanese people, because getting to know different people where you are traveling to, those sometimes are the reason why you end up going on the trip. You think you went for all these other sightseeing or food reasons or relaxation or wellness, whatever the purpose of the trip was. But you meet a couple of people that you have the most fantastic conversation with that you've ever had before in your life, or something happens in interacting with the people there that really stimulates some growth or new ways of thinking and everything. It's amazing how that happens, and people talk about that or they don't think about it, and then when it happens, they come back and say, oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I said that about the Japanese people. They were hard to communicate with because you have to know there's not a lot of Japanese spoken in Japan.
Not a lot of English.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, English. And so it is difficult. But even with the lack of being able to communicate, there's a connection to you. You know, if you can't find the track where your train is, somebody will come up to you and say, you know, can I help you? Or, you know, and you show them your ticket and they'll use hand language or whatever. I mean, but you're not going to be just stranded somewhere. I mean, they have this natural kind of community orientation and they help each other. And it's wonderful. And it goes all back to their beliefs that, you know, one day they might need help. So if you should help others when you see them needing help. You know, that's all part of their Buddhism and their spiritual beliefs. So I try to build these itineraries, like I said, to experience as many things that, my personal travel goals will, accomplish. And that's what I did for Japan. As you can imagine, my to-do list for every place that I stopped was long. And what I found, unfortunately, is that I never could do everything I planned to do. I mean, the language barrier is very difficult there. I mean, you'll be finding yourselves having to use Google Translate. You can't read anything. The kanjis, you think, oh, well, I'll be able to figure out certain things. You cannot figure this out. So it slows everything down. And then logistically, going from one place to the other, if you're not on a day tour or some organized group and you're having to find your way, it's more difficult. As well as in a lot of places, they don't have street signs. There's no numerical address. Google Maps is kind of all over the place. And it's very challenging. So I found that some of the things that I wanted to do, they didn't happen. So, you know, what it did do, though, is it forced me even more so to prioritize what I wanted to do daily and kind of rethink everything. But then just let go. I guess I got into that Zen attitude. What will be, will be. But you end up kind of doing that in Japan, which is kind of the way they live their life. You know, they do their must-dos, but everything else that they don't get to, it'll be okay. There's tomorrow. But with that, it makes you, or what I found, you immerse yourself so much into what you're doing in the moment. And you do let yourself go with the flow. And then if you can't do everything, what you've done in the things that you can do, it really has been a good experience. Because you're not rushing around, or you know you can't. You know, if you've stayed at this one temple an hour and a half longer, because it took you longer to get there. Once you got there, you liked it more than you thought. So that pushed everything to where you can't do your last activity in the day. So if you realize that at about 3 o'clock, then you don't push yourself anymore. You just continue to have a relaxing visit here. And then when you're finished, then you just say, well, I'll have to try to do that tomorrow, something else. So that's what happens to you a lot in Japan. At least that's what I found. So if you can experience everything that you plan, it's okay. And it's typical of the tourist phenomenon in Japan. You will hear more and more people who've gone there say, if you talk to them, well, we wanted to do that, but we never made it. So, you know, I kept thinking, well, you know, I'll be back and I'll do all these things that I haven't done when I come back. And I do hope to go back to Japan because it was a fabulous trip, fabulous trip. So bottom line, do a lot of pre-trip research, make a list of what you want to experience, prioritize that list, and you're going to have to do it daily. Then also take day tours. Get with your concierge and try to hit some of these must-dos efficiently in day tours, that they know these logistics problems. They know everything. And so they're pretty good at that. So I found myself doing that more than I thought I would do it, but it was very good. Plus, you have the English-speaking guides there. So that enlightens you to everything. I mean, you might see a symbol somewhere and you're just dying to know what it is. And if you can't communicate with anybody, you know it's something that is very important. But with the guide, at least you can ask them if they don't, you know, bring it out or whatever. So the day tours I found in Japan are very good in terms of being able to do more, okay? Then, of course, use a concierge. You know, have them help you daily with logistics, reservations, scheduling, and because they're your best friend in Japan, for sure. So that's my, I know you wanted me to be brief, but...
Well, no, I just it's a good warm up, but it does set us up really. That sets us up attitudinally for your actual top 10 list, which we should get into right now. And I just want to confirm these are not, in no particular order. You're going through your top 10. It's not like a countdown to your.
Oh no!
Okay.
No.
Gotcha. All right. So let's start. What is number one on your top 10 to do must do in Japan?
Well, before I get into that, my must-do list was 20. So you can imagine it, from just the brief intro that I've given you, it was definitely very difficult to get it to 10. So I'll be sneaking Catherine in a few more.
By the way, you are the boss of the show. If you had just told me, make it 20, we could have made it 20.
You sent me the outline to it. So, and okay. I don't want it to be too long, okay, to tell you the truth. Okay. But I'm going to sneak in a
few.
So, because I think that listeners will be interested.
Our listeners like your sneaky sneaks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Number one, my number one, and a lot of people's number one, is Mount Fuji. Mount Fuji has been on my travel bucket list for I don't know how many years. So no trip that I would take to Japan would not include seeing and photographing Fuji. What do they call it? Fuji-san. I mean, this mountain, well, first of all, it is sacred to the Japanese. And it really is the iconic symbol of Japan. So I wanted to see that. And when I started reading about where were the best place to see, they kept saying, Mount Fuji is not that easy to see or photograph because it's kind of tucked in the mountains in that area, and there's a lot of fog that's always in that area and clouds. So, you know, you kind of have to, on top of catching it at a lucky day or a sunny day, you have to be lucky to see it because it is kind of elusive.
It's so strange to think about it that way.
It is very strange. Yeah. So I targeted to see it at a village called Moto Hakone. And this is in the Hakone Mountains. And I spent about 4 or 5 days in Hakone. And I am so glad I did. At first I thought, well, do I want to go to Nagasaki or Nagoya versus the Hakone Mountains? But, you know, it said that was one of the best places to see Mount Fuji. So I thought, yeah, I can do that and do a couple of other things that seemed very cool in the area. So I decided to do it, which was a wonderful decision. But in Motohakune. And please forgive me how I try to pronounce these Japanese words or Russian words or whatever, because we talk about all kinds of things in different countries, and I'm terrible with linguistics. So, but this is a beautiful mountainous area, and this particular village has a gorgeous shrine complex. And when I tell you it's gorgeous, you can spend about three hours in this forest and going to the shrine and just sitting down and basically communing with nature. It's beautiful in this particular shrine area, as well as they have a wonderful museum called the Nara Kowa Museum. And this is a museum full of modern Japanese paintings that are done like in the old techniques with the gold leaf and the brush painting, but they're modern, like, you know, of their, say, their flowers and their birds, but the way they do it, and they're done, and a lot of them are done on screens. It's beautiful because it's a juxtaposition of old and new. Oh, I thought that museum was really, really nice. As well as in this area, you've got the Lake Ashi, and there's shops and restaurants. So I kind of got the feeling, I said, well, this is in Japan, but it's kind of like an Austrian village in the Salzkammergut Mountains or whatever. I mean, it really, even the air felt like Austria to me. But this is where I chose to see it, because from this lake, you can spot it really good if it's a clear day, as well as, you know, you can take, they have these cruises and these replica pirate ships that will cruise through this lake, and you can see it that way sometimes. And then they also have a cable car that you can approach this particular village from, of which I did the first day, because that was supposed to be, boy, you see it when this cable car is like, oh, really good. Well, the day I went, fog, wow, and kind of overcast and rainy, no way to see Mount Fuji. So I missed it the second day. The first day. The second day, I got there pretty early. I spent some time at the shrine. And then when I was looking for lunch, I asked somebody, okay, now where is that museum? I thought I kind of knew, because I had heard at the Narukawa Museum that I had just talked about with the modern Japanese paintings, is you, from the cafe, you can get a wonderful view of Mount Fuji if it's a clear day. And it was a clear day. So I asked where the museum was, and I thought, well, I will go eat a light lunch or at least have a cup of coffee. So when I got to the museum, it clouded up. And so, you know, I went through the museum, and Mount Fuji is not easy to see.
I can't believe it. It seems
No. And so I went, because I was going to eat first and take pictures and enjoy Mount Fuji, but the clouds came. So I couldn't see it. So I decided to go through the museum. I took my time. And in about 45 minutes to an hour, I went in. Oh, my God. There it was. It's like, you're just stunned when you see it, because it is majestic. I mean, you can see why Japan just, it makes the Japanese heart pound. It is really everything that people talk about, describe, have written about, painted about, et cetera. It is something else. So I'm snapping all kinds of pictures that I just forgo. I didn't even try to eat. So I decided I was going to go downstairs and go, because this museum is right on the lake. So I thought I'd go down into this viewing area, which is kind of specific for Mount Fuji viewing, and take some more pictures. I mean, I got some fabulous photos of Mount Fuji. I mean, it was really, it was much better than I had ever thought. But I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that, but I want to tell you a couple other places where you can find, you can see Mount Fuji if you don't want to go to the Hakone Mountains. First of all, there is a Lake Kawaguchiko. How do you like that, Catherine?
That was good.
And this is part of the Fuji Lake District. So it's not actually in the Hakone area, but it's all kind of, it all runs together because it's a mountain range. But that particular lake is also where you can see it. Then there is Kamakura, and that is a coastal town outside of Tokyo. So if you want to see Mount Fuji from the beaches and kind of get a photographs with the ocean and the beaches in Mount Fuji, that's supposed to be a really cool place to also see Mount Fuji. I don't know how much more there is to do there. That's kind of the problem. You know, if you want to go way out into somewhere, you're just going to capture, hopefully, the photograph of Mount Fuji. Another place is Inoshima, which is an island in Sagami Bay, which is about an hour and a half outside of Tokyo. Then also close to this Hakone area is a village or a town called Gotiemba, and it's very near Mount Fuji, and I almost went there, but I wanted to do some of these other things, and the big thing there is they have the Gotiemba Premium Outlet Mall, and that's not what I wanted to do in Japan, is go to a premium outlet mall. So all I could think about is this place was swarming with buses and people, and even though it had a great viewing of Mount Fuji, I didn't want that. That was not my Mount Fuji experience that I wanted. But some people might want to do that because, I mean, that's supposed to be a very good premium outlet mall. And, you know, some of the high fashion in Japan are very expensive. So you might want to do that. And then the last one, if you only go to Tokyo, you can see it on a clear day if you go up the Tokyo Sky Tree, which is basically the Sky Tree is like the Eiffel Tower of Tokyo. But you can see it from the Sky Tree. So, you know that. But to me, seeing Mount Fuji was magical. It was, like I said, much more exciting than I thought it would be. And anybody going to Japan, you should make every effort you can to see it because it's magnificent. And I have one other little story. Mount Fuji also said goodbye to me.
Oh.
And what happened was I was in the bullet train going from Hiroshima to Tokyo to catch my flight. And I was a little bit tired and I had been reading and I kind of looked up and I looked out of the window and went, oh my God, there's Mount Fuji.
Wow.
I mean, clear as day. So I got my camera out and I was trying to take pictures going in between the telephone poles and everything going like, I don't know, 300
miles
an hour.
Yeah.
But it was beautiful. I mean, it really was. And I just thought, oh my God, perfect send off, you know, from Japan. And it really was. That was another magic moment.
Wow.
I mean,
when you
just, you know, you're on your in your seat, you're kind of halfway sleeping at night, and you turn around, you go, oh my God, there's Mount Fuji.
That's so cool. I like that. You attract these magic moments. All right, number two.
Okay, number two is the Gion Geisha District in Kyoto. I mean, that is another must-do when you go to Japan. I mean, the two major cities are Tokyo and Kyoto, because Tokyo gives you the modern Japan and a whole different experience of Japan than Kyoto does. Kyoto is very traditional. It didn't really have any destruction during World War II, where Tokyo was, you know, almost completely razed. And Tokyo now is just a very modern new city. In Kyoto, they have this district called Gion, G-I-O-N. And this is known, like I said, as the Geisha District. And this is the area where you have the traditional tea houses called the Okaya, something like that. But this is where the geishas and the maiko are their basically apprentices, entertain guests. They either do tea ceremonies or that you can have drinks, and they dance and they play music. And it's a very, very unique experience what happens in those, because these geishas, I mean, I went to a performance. There's a theater called the Gion Corner Theater. It's very popular, and it has shows that kind of give you a mixture of a lot of different types of Japanese theater, like puppetry and geisha and that kind of thing. So I did that. But the movements, every movement that they do and how they execute or play and sing, everything is so trained and so high level. You can just feel the feminine excellence in the air, and it's mesmerizing, you know, just to be there and watch it. So that's where they are in Kyoto. Also in this district, you'll see a lot of the traditional machiya merchant houses. This was an area where, you know, a lot of commerce and trade went on a long time ago, and they still have those old houses like that. There's a beautiful temple called the Kenning Temple, and Zen garden all around it. There's a famous Yasaka shrine, which lots of people go to and touch it, and this kind of thing. And then in this area, there is a street called Hanimikoji. And it has all kinds of upscale restaurants and boutiques. So in Gion, you get the traditional feel of old Japan in Tokyo, in Kyoto. I liken it to the French Quarter in New Orleans. It's completely different than the other areas of Kyoto. You see some of the same thing, but this is where the geisha and the maiko are. And you know, it's been that way for hundreds of years. I have here that, you know, like Mount Fuji, if you go to Japan, you might want to cut this. If you go to Japan, you have to explore basically the world of the geisha, because the geisha and the maiko are really considered Japanese cultural treasures. They are, I don't want to say they're like movie stars, but they're, I mean, you know, when a girl decides she's going to go this route, she can never marry. She will live with other geisha and maiko and take care of the younger when she gets older. She has to be totally dedicated to all the Japanese arts that go into being a geisha and a maiko. So her life changes totally forever. So these special people are really valued and revered. And it's becoming a dying tradition, because not a lot of young girls want to go. I mean, it's difficult. They're very, very, their life is very structured.
It seems that there's probably a lot of misconceptions in the West, too, about the geisha.
Yeah, because they think they're, you know, kind of prostitutes or whatever. But that's not the case. No. And, I mean, they might be attracted to whoever if they're doing a performance and afterwards they, you know, end up being with them. But that's strictly up to them. That's not how they make their money. How they're paid is for their hospitality and their performance and that kind of thing. The sexual part of it is really not, quote unquote, part of the experience with a geisha. But But well, I guess what I'm trying to say, it does happen, but that's not expected. But it's hard to spot them. And everything you read, and when you go there, you find it's true. They're like Mount Fuji. All of a sudden, they're there. And I mean, I know myself, I read that, you know, the best time to be in Gion, in this area, is between 4:30 and 6, because that's when they scour across the street or to the tea houses real fast. And they are fast. They're very feminine, but they walk very fast in these little steps. So, you know, I likened it, besides Mount Fuji, is to seeing a deer. You know what I'm saying? If you see one, you go, oh my God, it's a deer. And then it's gone all of a sudden. The same thing. But Catherine, I was lucky again. When I was there, it was probably about 10 minutes to 6. And I had been walking all through that, didn't see anything. I was going, oh, well, you know, oh, well, I'm not going to get to see one. But all of a sudden, there she was. She went right across this little alley. And I have, well, I have this kind of phone strap, and my phone was ready, and I caught her walking in across the street. I couldn't believe it. It was like, it was another, like, God, that was a miracle. But they're very elusive. So, and don't think you can stop them and ask them for a photograph or anything like that. They won't even look at you. They just keep going. And it's actually very rude to do that. But if you don't go to the theater or go to one of the tea ceremonies or one of the tours, I don't want to say tours, but your concierge can arrange it for an evening with a geisha or a maiko, go to the theater, okay? But if you don't see any from there, there are fake geishas. And you will see them strolling around, not totally in Gion, in like the heart of where the real geishas are. But you can see them kind of around some of the temples in, you know, in that area. And if you see a geisha in the day strolling, she's a fake geisha. And she is very happy to take a photo with you for a little fee. Mm. So if you want to get a photo with the geisha, there are fake geishas. And I saw a lot of people doing it. But I have to say, it's not the real thing. And, you know, do something where you get some kind of feel, because they're so feminine and exotic, and you'll get that vibe. It's really I likened it a little bit to what I experienced in Thailand when they did all the dancing with the hands and everything. It's not totally, but I mean, even the how the geisha turned to the side and kind of squat, and they do all kind. Every little thing is choreographed and really does have a meaning, and it's something to see. So that's number two. Okay, now let's go back to Tokyo, or let's go to Tokyo.
For number three.
We've been in the mountains, Mount Fuji. We've seen the geishas in Kyoto, and we're going to go to Tokyo, where I started my trip. Now, the first thing that I did, which was basically the third day, because the second day I was still getting over my jet lag. And going to Japan from New Orleans is a long flight. I mean, you know, the jet lag factor is there. So I didn't do this until the third day. But the first full day, I went to the Asakusa neighborhood. Now, this neighborhood is old Tokyo. This is really where Tokyo started, in the most historic area of Tokyo. So, you know, I wanted to go to this area to get a feeling of old Japan, old Tokyo, that it was still in existence. Because, like I said, everything, most everything in Tokyo was damaged in World War II, and they've had so much modern development, there's very little that's historic. But this particular neighborhood, or in Asakusa, is definitely historic, and they have preserved that. So I headed there. Now, there are six must-do things. Just now, I don't want to say like this is like the, in the top 10, but when you go to Asakusa, you should do all these things. So that's why I'm going to name them all. First of all, you enter Asakusa through the Thunder Gate. Now, this Thunder Gate is a huge gate with three bays. And in the bays are, when I tell you, massive paper lanterns depicting thunder and lightning and everything. I mean, this gate is just spectacular. It is beautiful. So you enter through this gate. And once you go through there, it's considered sacred ground. And that's with any temple or any shrine. Once you go through the gate, you've passed from common to something sacred. Mm. So that's the first thing. Then you, well, then the next thing you should do is, and I'm going to kind of, I don't want to say reverse order, but I'm going to talk about the main things and then the last thing, but you might want to do what I said, the last thing first and then do this. Now, you know, it's, you decide what you want to do, but you should do all these things in the Asakusa area, is visit the Senzoji Temple. It's on everybody's must-do list. It is gorgeous. It is a magnificent ancient Buddhist temple, the oldest in Tokyo. And I mean, it is gorgeous. And, you know, as in all temples, you'll have like the outside washing well where everybody goes through the purification ritual. You take the little bamboo cups and you pour them on your hands, and then you pour some water in your left hand and you put it in your mouth. You rinse your mouth, you spit it out. But they do not go, Japanese would enter a temple without going through the purification ritual. Everybody does that. And then, you know, you've got your incense burners where people, you know, buy incense and then they say a prayer and they, you know, put the incense in the incense burner and they're pushing the smoke on them because it's supposed to be good luck and answered to their prayer. And then you go into the temple itself, and oh my gosh, beautiful. And you can say a prayer or meditate or whatever. I usually, what I do is say a prayer and light candles. It doesn't matter what type of church or temple it is. If there's a candle stand, I'm going to light one. That's just what I always do. But this temple, the Senzoji Temple, is absolutely stunning and opulent and gorgeous. So, and it's so old. That's what's amazing. So, you know, you definitely want to do that because you really get an idea of what a Buddhist temple is like, and especially a very old one, very regal and so different. You know, what kept amazing me is the Japanese architecture is so different from Chinese architecture. And it has some similar kind of things about it, but not really. I mean, I was blown away. And, you know, Buddhism actually came from China, supposedly, some people say from India, but to Japan. But I tell you, I just didn't see a lot of things that I equated with Chinese and Japanese architecture and spirituality. There were some things there, the incense burners and that kind of things. But there was a lot that was completely different. Then also, there's a 5-story pagoda there. It's beautiful. And most pagodas in Japan are 3-story. They're all odd number. Except I went to one, actually, and I forgot where it was. I think it was outside of Kyoto. Where exactly? It might have been in some part of the gardens surrounding the bamboo grove, but it had 4 stories. And I told the guide that. I said, I thought that all these pagodas were supposed to have odd numbers. And he said, I've never noticed that. I wanted to say, what? But this one in Asakusa has five, and it's beautiful. It's a classic pagoda that's gorgeous. So that's another thing. Then you in the kind of back area, there's a Shinto shrine, and the shrine is so different from the temple. It's much more simple. It's refined, but it's minimalistic. And, you know, the Shinto and Shinto religion or beliefs came way before Buddhism. And it really arose out of the worship of nature and the agrarian economy. And the Japanese really do still respect and follow a lot of the beliefs of Shintoism. And so it has a beautiful Shinto temple, shrine in the back, kind of off, that you should go see. And there's gardens all in this whole area. Once you go through that Thunder Gate, it's just beautiful. So there's a lot of places to take pictures, etc., you know, koi ponds and flowering trees, and I mean, it's just beautiful. And all these buildings, you know, the temples and the shrines, it's a special place. So, you know, have enough time to, you know, go through the garden. Then the last thing, and like I said, a lot of people do it the first thing because it's the first thing that you go through once you go through the gate. It's called Nakamise Dori, and it's this huge area, one street, but it's basically a pedestrian walkway. Nobody, you know, there are no cars, and they have about 100 shops, 50 and 50 on each side, and it is the best place in Tokyo to buy traditional goods and souvenirs. I mean, and you can bargain, and it is wonderful because in all of Tokyo, I didn't find a better place where you can get, you know, traditional goods than this area. So, and they have like restaurants or little street food kind of stuff on this particular street, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, you know, if you want to buy some souvenirs and et cetera, this is one of your key places to go. And then they also have around the temple and the shrine their little things, amulets that you can buy. I did the fortune stick and this kind of thing. There are lots of little things that they do in their religious practice that, you know, people from the West and in traditional Western religions don't do. So, you know, it's interesting to see everybody doing it. You might want to do some of the things. They write prayers down on amulets, or they will buy a good fortune little. It's usually in some kind of beautiful Japanese fabric that, you know, and you carry it with you, or I forgot exactly what they call those, but you'll see them at all the temples and shrines that you go to. But this big open air mall, which I call, is just fun, and you won't spend a lot of money. Two other things that you might want to do that I did when I was in the area is take a rickshaw ride, and you know, it's kind of cheesy as it sounds, it's actually fun. I took one, and this guy, he was great. He could speak English, and he gave me, you know, a little bit of a tour, and he was all dressed with those ninja shoes, and he was just, I mean, he was fast. It was really fun. So it was a great ride through the complex and then out, you know, on the major streets and going through this area. I mean, I loved it. It was thrilling, to tell you the truth. So I don't miss that, even though you think, oh, God, that looks so, you know, it's like a carriage ride. I mean, it's kind of like you got to do it, you know, but, you know, it's not that great. But this was actually better than I thought it would be. And I could get over how fast he could go. Mm. I thought, man, I can't believe he can. He's hauling boogie. So that, and then eat in one of the restaurants there. And I'm not talking about on Nakamizidori. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. But they have all these traditional Japanese restaurants kind of interspersed in there in these little kind of alleyways. I went to one, excuse me. Oh, it was delicious. They cooked the food right there at your table. They had like a little hot plate on there. Oh, it was delicious. And I mean, this was like, you know, the third real meal I'd had in Japan. And you walk into those hanging kind of fabric curtains. And the whole thing was so traditional Japanese. I loved every bit of it. So try to eat at one of those restaurants. Now, you won't be able to get a reservation. And you have to know in Japan, there are lots of places that you want to do that restaurants that you can't get reservations and people stand in line. But in Japan, they are the best line keepers or standers you can imagine. They're all orderly. They don't break up and people are just calm. They just wait till their turn. So, you know, don't miss. If you're hungry, eat a meal at one of those restaurants. Okay, so that was really my first, what I consider my first full day. I thought it was super interesting, and it gave me a really good introduction to the spiritual kind of majesty of ancient Japan, because it's still there. I mean, even in the modern cities, I mean, people do, they do go to the temples or the shrines sometimes after work just to kind of regroup and meditate. But it's part of what's in their mindset, even though they're not religious. It's very funny. They don't have any real kind of like Ten Commandments or, you know, catechism or anything like that. But they've been taught it either through family or whatever. And it's part of their consciousness. So you need to do that. And that's a great place to start in Asakusa. Okay, then number four, actually another shrine or religious place, but it's a little bit different. This is the Meiji Shrine in Tokyo. Now, this shrine was created for or in honor of the Emperor Meiji and his wife, Empress Shokan. And it is located in the most gorgeous 170-acre forest of evergreens that you have ever seen. Beautiful. When I tell you these gorgeous trees in the middle of modern hustle-bustle Tokyo, it is something else. I mean, as you enter this particular shrine, if you look to the left, you see the Olympic Stadium, okay? But if once you go into the Torii Gate, which a Torii Gate is what everybody or most people know as just two columns with the, you know, a beam across the top. And those are, you know, when you're going into a shrine, that's the kind of gates you go into. If you're going into a temple, it has doors. So you'll know the difference, okay? But this was a Shinto shrine, and it was not painted that orangey red that you see a lot of them. This one was basically like a stained wood, very rustic. And then it had the little chrysanthemum, gold gilded chrysanthemum, looking medallion at the top. So it was something. This was the gate to the Meiji Emperor's shrine. So you see how they combine the simplicity and nature and basic, nothing opulent, with that tad of regal gold and the symbol. That is a lot of how the Japanese are. They are so quality oriented, but they are very simple, but they're very refined. So you go in this huge gate, and then you start walking these paths that lead to the shrine itself. And in this forest, it is, I mean, it's, you can just feel, you can feel like, you know, Shintoism, or how the Japanese get into nature. Because in Shintoism, it's basically the worship of nature and how that interrelates to man. And they believe everything has a spirit in it, whether it's a rock or it's a leaf or it's water, or if it's, you know, man-made or made by nature. Everything has a spirit in it. So, and they believe that good spirits and good nature basically has a lot of calming ability. And this is what you feel when you walk in that gate. It is so calming. I mean, it is a perfect interrelationship between nature and man, or whatever. You get it. You get it. And just a little bit more about Shintoism. I mean, the way I understood it is that the Japanese believe a person must stay in tune or be able to relate to nature for spiritual enlightenment or well-being. So they go there just to be, you know, to be more well, to be enlightened, just to be in the presence in that environment, as well as they go to the shrine to say their prayers or whatever. But it's in this gorgeous forest that leads up to it. Oh, it is something. So I suggest a few hours there. Very soothing. I mean, that's all I can say. It is so soothing to be in that environment. And then when you leave, if you're hungry or you want to buy something, of course, they have a great gift shop. And this one is a really good one because they have some of very high quality traditional Japanese things that they make. In fact, I bought, it's the cutest thing, and most people think, oh my God, that was such a waste of money. But this was, and it's supposed to be good luck.
I know what this is.
This is a pig that is made from kimono, wedding kimonos, fabrics from wedding kimonos, and they've patched it together. It's beautiful, and it's supposed to be a good luck pig. So I bought it.
We'll have to take a little snapshot for our listeners.
But it's really one of a kind. It is. It is hard to resist.
You couldn't. You didn't.
No. And then they have all kinds of street, well, you know, food vendors right in front where you can sit outside and eat in front of the gift shop. Wonderful matcha ice cream. Oh, those matcha ice cream cones, they can be addicting. Now, if you have time after you go to the shrine, there's an area right close to there called Harajuku. And this is an area that is known for, well, it's the quirky fashion district. And even if you're not into the quirky Japanese twist on fashion, because they have this whole idea, or fashion's created from the concept of kawaii, which means cuteness. Like Hello Kitty was born in this area. And they like to be cute. They dress up as, you know, like all kinds of little cute fantasy.
Almost like cartoon characters.
Yeah. But it's still interesting to go into, because it's a lot of high energy in there. There's all kinds of different places to eat. Some street food, some just food emporium, lots of sweets in there. And I liked it. I went in there for a little over an hour, and I ended up in a sock shop, which if you go to Japan, you got to have socks because you'll be taking your shoes off. So I bought about 6 pairs of really cutesy socks with all kinds of, you know, characters and funny little things on them. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure you could probably find them in the West or in the United States, but not en masse like this. So, you know, if you want to do something, buy yourself something inexpensive in this area. And it's I thought it was kind of fun. Okay. Then number five, this is not like a particular, well, it's a place, but it's, you know, they have them in different areas of Japan, but it's basically, instead of staying in a hotel or Airbnb or couch surfing or in now capsule hotels, they have these hotels where, I mean, you have a little capsule that you can sleep in. I am so claustrophobic. I look at that and think, oh, God, there's no way. But you can stay in, and this is very popular, in what's called a ryokan or ryokan. And this is a traditional Japanese inn. And if you go to Japan and you want to experience their culture, you need to spend at least one night in a ryokan. I have to tell you, they can be a little expensive, but they are very authentic, especially if you get into a real good 4 or 5 star ryokan. But basically, this is a traditional inn that has the tatami mats. They have the communal baths there, the onsens, which are either can be, well, they're all segregated. Men and women don't go in together. But you can also have private baths. But typically, in the really good ryokans, which are in the mountains, are the springs and the water are natural hot water. Ooh. They're not, and they usually have sulfur in them or some kind of minerals in them. And they're very, I mean, the Japanese, this is part of their life. It's a ritual. I mean, if they don't have a natural onsen, they go to them that are artificially heated and et cetera. But in the ryokan, you'll have an onsen, okay? And of course, you'll probably have those sliding rice-paned window doors and windows. You'll sleep on the floor in what's called a futon. And this is not a futon where it was a couch and then you make it into bed. This is like a big sleeping pouch. it kind of looks like a Kleenex. You know, those little Kleenex pouches that you have. You get in the middle. It's the weirdest looking thing. But that's what the real ones look like, to tell you the truth. Well, that's what I think.
Wow.
And then they have the low furniture, et cetera. And you wear, what do you call those? Yukata, which is like a kimono, but it's cotton.
Mm.
And it has the big sleeves. It's like a robe, but you do the belt a certain way. And you put, you know, it's like right and left over rather than left and right over. They teach you how to put them on, everything. But I stayed in one in the Hakone area in the village of Hakone Machi. And mine was Senki Yamagaso. Oh, if you want to stay in the real thing, this is the real thing. Now, you know, it costs you about $400 a night to sleep on the floor. But this is the real thing. I mean, it is, I love this place. It was enclosed, it was about 6 to 8 little bungalows. And it was all around a garden, and the garden had, you know, a little pond and a place where you could sit in a big red umbrella and the beautiful, well, I was there during cherry blossom season, but the cherry blossoms were flowering, all the plants and the birds singing and the fountain water running. I mean, it was just like, I mean, it was like it was like heaven in Japan. I mean, it was so, nature was so imbalanced and so Japanese. It was wonderful. So they had these little bungalows, okay? And in your bungalow, you had a living room. And in the living room, you had the low table, the low chairs, the tatami mats. When you go in, you have to take your shoes off and you either use the slippers or the socks. And then in the living room, they have a little bay area. And you'll see this in tea houses. This bay area, there'll be a scroll and then ikebana flower arrangement. And this is part of the ceremony in reverence to a certain concept. And they change them seasonally and this kind of thing. But this was classic, okay? Then you have your bedroom. And in your bedroom is that big futon. And you got the window with the rice. But, you know, when you look in there, you think, oh, I'm going to sleep on the floor tonight. Oh, I wonder how that's going to go. So, but you then you ignore it. And then, you know, you have a full bathroom. But this, and mine actually had like a little kitchen in it too. But I love this place. I mean, when I first walked in it, I said, this is so, cozy is not the right word. This is, because it was refined, but it was quiet. There's so much quietude. But then you also heard the birds because I opened up the windows and so I could hear the birds and the water fountain. I just loved it, okay? And the cool mountain air, that's another thing. I kept thinking, this is like Austria. This feels like Austria to me. Then at this particular ryokan, they have a wonderful private onsen that's really kind of fancy. I mean, I don't want to say it's fancy, but it has these beautiful rocks, and they get it spick and span clean for you. And, you know, the hostess or the other attendants, they come and tell you when it's ready, and they show you how to get there, and you've got your yukata on, and they make everything just so for you, and then they leave, and then when you're through, you know, you've got everything you need to get back to your little bungalow, and they're right there waiting, bowing. I mean, it's nothing forced. I mean, it's not like they're trying to give you a snapshot of Japan or old Japan. It's just real. This particular ryokan has been in the family for several generations. So they take so much pride and they love this place. You can tell it in the garden and everything. It's well maintained. It's spick and span. They're so nice to you. When you get there, you automatically have a cup of green tea and a sweet while they're checking you in. Then they scurry you off to your bungalow, and they, you know, help you with your suitcase and your clothes, and they, you know, show you how to put the yukata on, and then you have a choice of a dinner, and you can either have a full katsuki meal or a lighter, and they show you the menu, and you pick it out, and then they come back, and they're bringing this, and they're in kimono, and you, and it's just. It is really the real thing, which is so delightful. And what I kept thinking of when I was there, I thought, you know, if somebody would ever really want to kind of really get away and have quietude in a space that is got all kinds of good vibes, this is a place to come. If you want to heal or you're grieving or you need to just be by yourself, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. And these hostesses and the owners are so sweet. They will you'll have everything you need. So it's luxurious in a very simplistic way. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it, but this particular ryokan is absolutely, I couldn't fault anything about it. I absolutely loved it. And even sleeping on the floor. And I survived that. I can't say I had the greatest night of sleep, but I didn't have a bad one. And I have to tell you, all the beds that I slept in Japan, and I stayed in 5-star hotels everywhere I was hard as rocks. So... I was a little prepared to sleep on the floor. because I had been sleeping on other beds that were hard as rocks. So that was my number five.
Let's take a little break here, and let's get to our how-to, the midway point here of your top 10 that's sneaking into top 20.
Yes, it is sneaky. Yeah. I told you, Catherine, I couldn't help it.
I know.
And
I
this
know.
Is very focused now.
I know. I see. Okay. Well, let's take our little break here. And I want to give our listeners a how to, but this one I put a little twist on it. Astrid, how long before a trip should a traveler start working on their itinerary? So this is like a pre-trip planning. You're so famous for that. And then also, I personally, this is where you've impacted me so much, is you have a special formula for how you lay out each of your days. I'm wondering if you could give us that tip as our how-to of this show.
Okay, well, I kind of try to keep it bottom line. But, you know, in terms of, you know, how long before the trip you should start doing the itinerary. And, you know, to me, it all depends, you know, on where you're going. What type of trip? Is it going to be an adventure trip, cultural immersion, wellness, specific interests like gardens or theaters? That plays into, I mean, some trips are very easy to build an itinerary.
They build themselves practically.
Yeah. The other ones, you know, it takes a lot of research to do it. Then how long your trip is going to be. Is this the first time you're going or is this the second or third time? Those itineraries are built totally differently, and, you know, some take longer than others, basically. But research shows, and I agree with this because I do this, most people start building their pre-trip or start doing their pre-trip research about 6 months ahead. That's typical. That's when people start really thinking about going to a particular place. They start doing research. And it starts coming into focus. That's exactly what I do. And I'm always buy a travel journal. And when I start doing my research from the very beginning, I start writing all of the different ideas that I possibly want to do or the must do's. Mm. Just like we're talking, there's must do's and there are wanna do's. Okay. And there's always this trade off is, you know, do I want to let go of this must-do to do all these want-to-dos, or I can't do these want-to-dos because I have to do these must-dos? So you start making those lists in the particular areas where you'll be traveling. Then what I do is I start budgeting an ideal trip. If I wanted to do everything and stay as long as I want, you know, how much is that going to cost me? Now, I'm lucky because I'm retired. So time is not a factor for me, but a lot of people can only travel for 5 days or maybe 9 days at the most, or 2.5 weeks or whatever. So time is a very big factor, as well as cost. So what I do is I build this imaginary, perfect, you know, budget and look at how long that would take me. And then I start paring it down to reality. And I look at the must-dos and then, you know, how long or how much I really want to spend on this trip. And then I focus in, okay, it's going to be 10 days. So I have got to do these key things. And I typically know that I can do it based on doing 2 or 3 must-dos a day if I'm really cramming it or you know, two is really the best kind of idea to have because you don't want to do too much. But then there are other things that you can combine in a certain area that might not take as long, et cetera. So I usually book the trips out and have decided my basic itinerary without being totally specific, day one, day two, day three, 3 months out. That's when I book the trips, okay? And I know that's enough time for me to do must-dos and want-to-dos, you know, in how I think a trip will flow. Okay, then a month out ahead of time, I do the thing that a lot of people don't like doing, but it is very helpful, is I plot all these places on the map.
Mm.
So I can get an idea of area. So I know that these want-to-dos I can do with these must-dos because they're all in, say, Asakusa.
Mm.
You know, I might have wanted to do the rickshaw ride, you know, in certain other place, but it was right there in Asakusa. So I clicked that off of my want-to-do and that kind of thing. So you want to try to get efficient with your time and your logistics because I have found that traffic is a problem everywhere in the world now. And you do not want to be saying, I'm going to be doing this in the morning, that in the afternoon. I want to do that. I want to eat there in the evening. And you're going to across town. You're going to, it's going to fall apart.
And you're going to fall apart.
Yeah. Well, then you'll just say, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
And which is a shame. So try to map it out in the area. Okay. Then once you, and then trying to do it day by day, you know, you don't have to make it exact. Because what I do is I, you know, kind of like draft it. Then when I get to the hotel, the first thing I do is I go over what I want to do with the concierge and show them how I have it kind of planned. And they'll say, oh, no, you need to do this. They'll help you fine tune it. Then they'll say, okay, you got to have a reservation for this, or I'll get you with this day tour. If you do this day tour, you knock out four of these things in one day. You know what I'm saying? So that is invaluable. I do that all the
time. That's a great tip.
And let me tell you, in Japan, the day tours are great because they really facilitate you seeing a lot more. Because here again, like I said, the language barrier and the logistics, it's not easy. So that's basically how I start planning and kind of, you know, getting an itinerary to come into focus.
And then for your normal day, you like to have a couple of activities in the morning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Normal day, especially for Japan, know that you can only do a couple of things in the morning, two, maybe three. The best bet to get the most is to take the day tours or some kind of organized tour. And then in the afternoon, two at the most, because you'll be getting tired around 3:30, and you'll want a tea break or ice cream cone break. You're going to have the dropsies.
Yeah.
And then at night, you know, depending on whether you want to make the meal is your last function of the night. You know, when you're a solo traveler, doing things at night can be a challenge, you know. So if you don't have something already planned that is going to take a certain amount of time and logistics, a lot of times I just make having a real nice meal sitting outside at a nice restaurant by the hotel my last activity. And I might walk around or whatever if I know it's safe. So, you know, I keep a flow in the activities. And if I want to cram in a lot, I usually do the day tours because they're more structured to get you from point A to point B, in and out, et cetera. I try not to do too many of them. But if there's a tremendous language barrier like there is in Japan, and logistics are very difficult because of that, primarily, and taxis are expensive, so you have to do the subways, and to figure out all of that takes you longer because you can't read, and you're getting Google Translate out, and your concierge has told you to get to this train, to that train, and you're not quite sure. You just, everything slows down. So that's kind of what I think, Catherine. 2 in the morning, maybe 3, lunch, long, good lunch to where you relax, you know, your feet don't hurt as much. Because after about the 6th day of pounding of the pavement, you're going to start hitting the brick wall. In the afternoon, an activity, a tea time or a break for ice cream or whatever, maybe one more thing, big supper. Or if it's a little supper, then you go and you do the theater, or maybe you do a food tour at night or whatever. Or you just decide you're going to eat a real nice dinner and take your time. So that's kind of the way I do it, because I have found that if I try to do too much, I don't enjoy myself anymore.
See, I love that little formula of yours because it helps give a little structure so that you can actually achieve, you have more realistic expectations about what you can do in a day.
Yeah, because not only if you get there, but it's how much can you absorb, too, of what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it doesn't, if you do too much, you just start tuning out.
Yeah. Well, we have this how-to tip for you because we know the Solo Travel Talk listeners love how-tos. And this how-to tip was brought to you by Astrid's Travel Club. Astrid is launching a travel club. She has a trip this planned for this fall to Cartagena. And the travel club is really for people who want the forum so you can connect with other travelers. You want to go on adventures, but you don't necessarily want to go completely solo. And really, you enjoy the tips of Astrid Travel. And you can just go to astridtravel.com, click on tours, and there is complete information about Astrid's Travel Club. And that is the sponsor of this how-to tip.
Just one little thing, Catherine, because we just launched the Astrid Travel Club. We're very excited about it. Bottom line, we will be offering affordable luxury trips for small groups, groups typically 6 to 8 people. Some trips will be women only, some will be mixed, some could be male only if we have, response wanting those kinds of trips. No single supplement, one flat charge, basically most all your meals involved, and great itineraries with, some kind of focus. My trips, Catherine has said in the past, my itineraries have flair. Well, I love to do interesting things. So it'll be a mix of very interesting things, some of the must-dos, great restaurants, enough free time to where you can either go off by yourself and, just go to the spa or go to the pool or shop by yourself or sit in a restaurant. Just quiet time or whatever. So you'll have enough free time on your own. And then there's going to be a lot of fun activities. Yeah. Like in Cartagena, we're going to go to a salsa club and learn salsa. And we're going to take a literary tour of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He was definitely the first Nobel Prize winner for literature. And he is a magnificent writer. So we will be learning. In Cartagena, he felt was magical. And it spurred a lot of his imaginative writings in his novels. So you'll be learning all about his life, what he loved in Cartagena, the places where he hung out. Lots about his literature. So that's one little thing. And I've got all kinds of things.
I know. Well, it's exciting. And I love that you've been very thoughtful about it. And it really is for like-minded folks. So that'll be good.
Yeah. Like we don't want to be just your regular tour. Mm-mm. Because there's a lot of good ones out there. We want to have a focus. Like I said, no single supplement. You get your own room, 5-star hotel. Everything is taken care of you. Itineraries will be interesting, fun, I think high quality, especially for the price, and we'll give you free time. You don't have to do everything
although you probably will want to. All right. Well, and we'll have a whole episode that's just about the travel club. So we should get back to your list for Japan. We are at number 6.
Okay, you see, it's hard for me to stay on track.
I'm staring you back here. Let's go.
I love travel.
Number 6.
Okay. You'll never guess this one, Catherine. Because this one is probably the most unique must-do that I have on this list. But I really think it's a must-do. So I got it in the top 10. It's in Hakone, in those mountains, and it's the Hakone Open Air Museum. Now, I'm personally an art lover, and consequently, I go to a lot of art museums when I travel, all types of museums. I know lots of people don't like to do museums. They feel like, I don't want my vacation to be a field trip, or they just don't like museums. They don't want to go in there and look at this stuff and read about it. And I get it. But there's some museums in the world that really you shouldn't miss, even if you could care less about art, because there's something so really fabulous about this. And this Hakone Open Air Museum is one of these, in my opinion, not to be missed when you're traveling to Japan. I mean, it is spectacular. The museum is set in the mountains, first of all, so it's this harmony of nature and art. It got two main kind of concepts to it. You have the outdoor sculpture museum, where they have 120 absolutely spectacular, fantastic, unbelievable sculptures by very famous Japanese and internationally famous sculptors. Beautiful hilly kind of lawn that you have a walking path that goes through, and at each, I mean, I think I took 500 pictures there. I mean, a lot, because all of these sculptures and from different angles, some of them move, some of them don't. They're all kinds of from, you know, classical sculpture look to very contemporary to just, you know, way out the forms, etc. I just was mesmerized when I was there. I ended up staying there 3 hours, which I thought I was going to only do, an hour, maybe a little longer. Then I'd go to another museum in Hakone. It's kind of spread out a little bit, but I thought I could get in more than one. I completely let go of the second one. Stayed here. It was that good. They have interior spaces or exhibition halls. One is specifically dedicated to Picasso. They have a whole Picasso exhibition hall, 2 stories, with paintings, sculptures, and ceramics by the artist. And then a lot of photos of him taken during the different times of his life. I mean, this is astounding in the middle of the mountains in Japan. It is extraordinary. Then they have other exhibition halls that have different traveling exhibitions that are also very, very high quality. And then, you know, you're going to spend enough time there where you're going to need a cup of coffee or something to eat, and they have a great cafe there. And it's beautiful, too. You can sit outside amongst some of those sculptures. Gift shop, again, top-class gift shop there. So it's hard to really describe why this museum is so awe-inspiring, but you really have to go there to get what I'm saying. But to give you a real introduction to it, more than just taking my advice or listening to what I'm saying, there's a website that you can go to called thecreativeadventurer.com, and there's a great guide to the Hakone Open Air Museum. Has lots of photographs of the sculptures, the ground, the elegant architectural buildings, and the indoor spaces. So you'll really get a better idea of how unbelievably fabulous of a sculpture museum that this is in the whole world. And like I said, I was so blown away personally because I didn't expect this at all. I didn't know they were going to have that much sculpture. I thought maybe there'd be 12 pieces, you know, and I didn't know the Picasso Museum was going to be there at all. And then just the beautiful mountains surrounding everything, and you're out and you're walking. Oh, again, it was, you know, I was just completely blown away. And I kept thinking, you know, how is this kind of caliber of museum in Japan? And no offense to the Japanese, but I kept thinking, you know, only the French can create something this subliminatively, you know, creative and exquisite. I mean, it was it's really as good as it gets, as good as, and even if you don't like art, you're going to love being here. And it's a little side note, the French love the Hakone area. And, you know, there really a lot of the many repeat tourists that come back to this area. And I always say, where there's a lot of French people traveling, there's got to be something good. because they don't leave France if they don't they don't find something else, because they think France is it and there's no other place. You know, there are a lot of other things to do in Hakone that I'm not going to go into, because then you'll spank me or you'll get really mad and you'll just cut me off. But this particular museum, I mean, really, if you go to the Hakone Mountains, you must go here, because it is extraordinary. So bottom line, spend 4 days. If you have the luxury to do it, 4 day minimum in this Hakone area to experience all these unique and enriching sites.
It sounds fantastic.
They have this Venetian glass museum. Now I thought, how in the world, in the middle of the Japanese?
Only you would find this, Astrid, by the way.
Oh no, this place will blow your mind too. Now it's a little bit more selling and gift shop. It's not high minded art. But it has got some fabulous glass, contemporary, old. They have all this old, ancient Venetian glass in there, and the grounds are spectacular. I mean, I spent there too about 3 hours, and I thought I was going to spend 45 minutes. Mm. I mean, So, and this museum and kind of Venetian gift shop, food, you know, and they have all these places overlooking the mountains you can sit out and eat. And they have these trees that are made from crystal. The leaves are all crystal and they all sparkle. And these ponds and everything where the ducks are going around in these glass trees. And it I can't describe it like it really is, but you're just going, this is blowing my mind. In Japan?
That's cool.
I mean, it is really cool. So, I mean, there's other things like that. And this museum has been there for like 40 years. I thought, well, you know, is this kind of something like, you know, it was a kind of a Walt Disney idea at first or what? No, this is, you know, I think some Italians wanted to do something really fine in this area. But people love to come to the Hakone Mountains. There's a great vibe there. The ryokans, the food is good. You're in nature, etc. So 4 days minimum if you go to that area. If you want to kind of, you know, really see some things that make taking that sojourn there, you know, from Tokyo or Kyoto, that's what I suggest. Okay, number 7, we're going to head back to Kyoto. Now, as I said at the beginning of the show, Kyoto has 17 UNESCO World Heritage Sites.
I did not know that.
I mean, that is amazing. So, you know, if you wanted to go see all of that, it would be, you know, I don't know how long that would take you. Oh, definitely over probably about 2 weeks to give it justice, because you're going to have to stop to eat and then you're going to be driving here and there. But one of those places is the Arashiyama area. And in the Arashiyama area, which is on the outskirts of Kyoto, and this area is noted for its scenic beauty. It's basically nestled in the Storm Mountains along the Oi River. One of the UNESCO sites in this area is the spectacular bamboo grove or the bamboo forest. These bamboo trees, I think, are like 2,000 years old. They are like skyscrapers. This is skyscraper tall bamboo, thick. And it has beautiful paths that you can wander through, just like the Meiji Evergreen Forest and the Meiji Temple. But this is bamboo all in this one area. It you've never seen anything like that. And it has a different feel than a regular forest. But then there's also other, you know, trees. Once you get out of the bamboo forest itself, it's another like spiritual experience to go in there. You can't describe it. You have to go there to experience it. In this area too, they have the Tenryuji Temple. Just trust me, the temple at Arashiyama, it's beautiful, and it's totally different than really any of the temples you see. They all have the same elements to it, but there's always a different expression. This one is quite beautiful too, and the gardens all around it are wonderful. And I was there during the cherry blossom season, and those cherry blossom trees in that garden, all different colors, light, dark. It was fabulous. Then in the gardens too, along all these paths, some of which is through the bamboo grove and some are kind of out of it, they have all these Shinto shrines. Mm-hmm. They have shrines there. And people go and, you know, they do their prayers or they throw coins in and they do all kinds of different things. You get caught up in all of this. And then you're seeing the Japanese women in their kimonos and other tourists. And everybody's just kind of, there are a lot of people there, which is unfortunate. But there's still some kind of flow to the whole area. Because the magnificence of this nature is just, I mean, you cannot believe it. Like I said, this is a skyscraper bamboo. Yeah. Then, if you like monkeys, there's the Iwatayama Monkey Park. And a lot of people go there. You know, I'm not into monkeys, so I passed on that. I shopped instead. Because right before you get to the temple, before you get into where the forest is a whole two shopping streets. In a couple little alleyways off of that. So you have shops and restaurants. And it's a little touristy, but I got a matcha ice cream cone. And then, I bought a few little things. You know, I think I bought some slippers and I don't know what else. But it's not expensive. One thing I did do when I was there, which I loved, was a lunch cruise on kind of like a flatboat. And everybody got their individual hibachi. And, it was really cool. It was kind of like a rural Japanese meal with different courses to it. Mm. And you're all sitting squunched up in the flatboat with the table that goes through the middle. It's beautiful on the Oi River, and the breeze is coming through. And the day we were there, somebody was playing the flute in the on the banks, and it was really special. Hmm. I mean, it's a little touristy, but not that touristy, you know. If you're interested in that or you like doing things like that, I recommend doing it. So the best thing, if you go to Arashiyama, which you should go, if you don't go there, it's like you've missed something extraordinary. Hmm. Do it in a day tour and just spend the whole day out there, you know, because that's how much time you should spend there. You should not rush anything there because it's going to take you some time to really go through the forest, the temple, the shrines, take all your photos, have the lunch cruise if you want to go see the monkeys or you'd rather shop. I mean, don't push yourself to try to do it in a half a day. That's what I'm trying to say. So that's number 7. Now, number 8, which is outside of Tokyo too, but in another area, is called Kinkakuji, the Gold Gilded Temple. How'd you like that?
I was going to say, you're getting better as we go along here.
But it's one of the most famous and loved temples in Japan. It is, it has that Japanese look, but it's different. It was originally a shogun's retirement villa, and now it's a Buddhist temple, so you can't really go into it. I didn't see anybody go into it, but it's the setting is beautiful. First of all, there is a lake in front of the temple. And around the whole lake is what you call a go-around classical Japanese garden. And the name for those gardens are Murimache, or what I think that's what our guide had told us. But it's set up to where the structure reflects all the time in the water from all kinds of different angles, depending on the sun. And in this garden is typical, the bridges, the plants, the rocks, the flowering trees. Then you have all these little strategic places to sit, etc. But to have this gorgeous three-story temple, which two of the top stories are completely in gold gilt, and then there's white in the bottom, and that reflecting off of the pond is like, it's one of a kind. And our guide told us that the reason why the gold was put there, what really makes this really special, is because the Japanese believe that gold purifies any pollution or any negative thoughts or feelings, especially about like death or something bad. So this is a place where people come to relax and purify themselves. And, you know, if there's anything that, you know, is, I guess, got them down or maybe depressed or whatever. But this is a regal Japanese temple and gardens, and it exudes what I call relaxed refinement. Because you'll go to a lot of Japanese temples, and they're like power. You think, oh, shogun. I mean, they're like really big, and everything is big, and just you could feel the power.
Like martial energy.
Oh, yeah. But this doesn't have that at all. Now, I have to tell you, even though it's breathtaking, this place has so many tourists, and that was the biggest bummer. But I still was able to take some of what I consider my best photos from my Japan trip. You just have to kind of be dogged and just wait for that right moment, and, you know, get your in your mind set what you want to photograph, and then just get ready to strike when you get a little opening with people not around. And the Japanese are really nice. If they see you trying to take a particular picture for they'll back off easy. Wow. They won't just push right in front of you, or they don't care, walk right. No, they don't. They are very in tune, and that's very rare, because I find people all over, they don't care. They just walk in front of you no matter what. They think, oh, God, another one of those people that just take pictures all the time. Okay, another shrine. And I know I'm giving you some, you know, shrines, but every one of these that I'm telling you about, the temples and the shrines, they're all so astoundingly important and beautiful, and really give you a good idea of the nuance into Japanese temple and shrine architecture, the beliefs, the sacredness of where they're located. There's many more things involved in it, and it goes to they do go to these temples a lot, and it's not just something that's, you know, a UNESCO site. I mean, it is still important, because the Japanese are very much about their traditions, and that's key to their culture and understanding their culture. Okay, number 9 is the Fushimi Inari Shrine. Now, this shrine, it is one of the shrines that you see all over anything advertised and going to Japan, especially if you're in the Kyoto area. Because it is noted for 10,000 torii gates. And in the shrine itself, it was originally dedicated to the goddess of Inari, who is the patron of rice, sake, and prosperity. Mm. And let me tell you something. Rice and that agrarian culture and economy that started Japan is still at the root of their beliefs of nature and how it relates to prosperity. And because it was the foundation of the Japanese becoming an economic power. That's how, you know, the tribes and the shoguns evolved from the clans, you know, with the rice and trading the rice and fighting for it and all of that. You know, it's very important. Well, this particular shrine is in the Inari Mountains. And, you know, these gates, first of all, each gate is donated or has been donated by a particular business. And it takes, if you want to go through the whole path that takes you through all the 10,000 gates, which is basically a mountain path. It takes you 2 hours to do it. And you better be in shape because it's not just a little slight incline. But people do this all the time, and they do it to promote prosperity in their lives. It's like a pilgrimage, short pilgrimage walk. Like me, if you were on a tour, you didn't have time to walk the whole thing. So they have a little detour path that you can kind of get it. But it is unbelievable. 10,000 torii gates. You know, you can't, and each one has a signature of the business or whoever that donated it. Now, also within this whole shrine complex, you have the grand shrine. Then you have a lower shrine, a middle shrine, an upper shrine, and auxiliary shrines. And this kind of like mixture of different shrines in terms of size and importance, you'll see in a lot of areas that, you know, are sacred sites, basically, in Japan. But these are beautiful. These are really beautiful. And it's so focused on this whole area of personal prosperity. So, I mean, this is one of the big ones in Japan, this particular shrine. Also there you're going to see, and I saw this in Tokyo, in the Unio Park. They have a couple of smallish Shinto shrines, and they had these foxes with red scarves, these carved foxes with red scarves around their neck. And I thought, what is that? And I finally asked the guide in Kyoto, when they had all these foxes in this Inari shrine. I won't try to say the first word again, but you know what I'm talking about. But he said that the red scarves around the neck are supposed to dispel demons or any bad spirits. The Japanese are very, they don't tempt the spirit world. They try to stay in the good side of consciousness and how they live their life and what they think. They're not messing around with anything that they think could cause them bad luck, etc. But really, people, like I said, from all ages come here to pray for good fortune, success in business, and really in hopes of their wishes to come true. So this is a very special place, and it has been very special for, I don't know how long, but a long, long time. So you can imagine how many prayers and how much, you know, that kind of thought and energy has happened on this place. Now, it's crowded too. So it's best if you come very early or late in the day. And I think it is even open in the evening sometime. But unfortunately, tourism with the tour buses and everything, that's kind of what's messed things up. But you just have to know that it's going to be there. And if you can come there early or late, it's the best time. Also, plan to spend some time there because they have some great street food in front of there. I mean, some really good, and especially like the sweets that they have. They're particularly, one is called Tsujiura Senbi, something like that. But it is a type of fortune cookie. And it supposedly, or they say that the origin of the American Chinese fortune cookie was here.
Oh, really? Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. But it all goes with prosperity, good fortune, all of that. So, don't miss the street food here. They got a lot of it, and it's good. It's good stuff. And people, you know, they just relax and make a half a day minimum of it or whatever. And you'll get caught up in that kind of, I guess what you'd say, flow. So, if you really have the time, do the whole 10,000. I mean, you never know. You might hit the jackpot afterwards.
Okay, here we go.
Number 10. Okay. Can you guess what that is?
You've hit all the ones I was thinking of, so I'm curious to see what number 10 is.
Okay. Number 10 is the Hiroshima Peace Park and Museum. You know, now some travelers leave this off of their must-do list when they go to Japan. But I have to say, as an American, I felt drawn here to just pay my respects because all of these people that were innocent victims of the first atomic bomb blast, you know, I just feel so bad because that happened. And I mean, I feel bad for all people who've lost their lives in wars, innocent people or soldiers, because to me, war is just not the way to solve things. But I really did want to go there. And I must say, I was not sorry one bit that I took the time to go all the way down south. Because it's pretty far, and you have to take the bullet train, and to get back to Tokyo to catch my flight, I mean, I had certain time constraints, but it was really worth it. Because, you know, it's a whole complex of things, and like, before the bomb hit exactly where it hit, and this is where the whole Peace Park and Museum is, it was the building that's now the A-bomb dome was the most beautiful building in Hiroshima, and it was the commercial and trade center of this area, and really very important to Japan. That's obviously why they hit this building with the bomb. But it didn't go all the way to the ground, so they've made it now like the monument. So that's the kind of the center stone, I'd say, of the Peace Park. Then you have the Hiroshima Museum, which is very difficult to visit. It's terrible. I mean, you need to see it, but it's pretty bad because you see everything about Kyoto before. They even have a live kind of image to where life was going on, and then, you know, all of a sudden the plane is coming in, how it was when the bomb hit, how it exploded, the mushroom cloud, and just what, you know, they simulated what it did to the building and the people all there within like a 10-minute period. Oh, my God. It's terrible. Then, you know, you see a lot of the pictures of what happened to the people and the illnesses they developed because of the bomb and just how completely incinerated everything was after it, and then how Hiroshima began to heal and come back. And you see clothes and all these artifacts from, you know, before and after it. It is really moving. I mean, you know, I've been to the Holocaust Museum, and I haven't been to Auschwitz. I went to Sachsenhausen and one other, Birkenau or something. I've been to two concentration camps, and my mother was born in Berlin and went through the war and that whole period in Berlin. It's left her a changed person because it happened to her when she was a young child, but she survived. Mm. She survived and made it out. And just when you see what happened to all these innocent people, and you see it in these photographs and some of these depictions, it's pretty strong. Then they have in the complex, too, a beautiful area called the Children's Peace Museum, which they have, oh, this sculpture and this girl with the origami or crane on top. But one of the things it's famous for is, besides a piece of sculpture, is all of these, it's over like thousands of paper origami cranes that are put together in these hanging rows, and each one is with a prayer for the children lost or that basically developed leukemia from the blast, which were a lot of children. Mm. You know, a lot of children ended up developing leukemia. Then they have a send-off for the A-bomb victims, which is this kind of strange-looking arched tomb that's really, I depict it as another piece of sculpture, but Below the tomb is a stone chest with all the names of the 220,000 victims. That's how many people ended up being incinerated or dying because of this one blast. Oh, it's terrible. This really, it's hard to go there. But I really believe that if you are a thinking person and you're really trying to be a responsible person in how you consider political issues or even how you interrelate with people, think of this is makes you really think about how what man can do to each other for all the wrong reasons, in my opinion. But they also have this enormous peace bell that you can go and ring, just kind of like saying a prayer, but, you know, ring it for world peace. And of course, I went over there, bong, this big bong, peace flame. And it's beautiful. They have these different sculptures and you walk through it. But I must tell you, I know everybody experiences going here differently, but it's eerie, in my opinion, there, even though the park is beautiful now, but it's still eerie. It's extremely thought-provoking. I mean, you find yourself wanting to cry. You just feel helpless. I mean, it's like you almost feel sick to your stomach. At least that's the way it hit me. The horrors of war. You know what I'm saying? I mean, even though the park was beautiful, it's like you wouldn't know anything happened to it, but I don't care. It just, ugh. It really, that's the way I reacted to it. And so, but I think everybody who goes there, they can't help but thinking, never again. The world has got to find a better way to resolving political, economic conflicts than resorting to annihilating innocent people. I mean, you know, let's go after the big boys that are causing the problem. Shoot them or knock them out. I hate to say that, but not innocent people. You know, it's awful. And I even think, you know, people in armed forces are kind of fodder sometimes for just not the right reasons. I mean, you got to be able to figure it out, to me, without slaughtering humanity. But you feel this when you go there. Similar, it's not quite like a concentration camp, but you start thinking. I mean, your mind goes into, you know, the dark recesses of helplessness and I guess you'd say just being completely like forlorn and just, you know, what's it all about, you know. And Hiroshima, in my opinion, is a stark reminder. So, you know, I'll kind of end this number 10 with saying, you know, not all places that you visit when you're traveling are uplifting and fun. And Hiroshima is definitely not uplifting. But it is very moving and thought-provoking. And that's why I put it on the top 10 list, because I don't think we need to forget about that. I don't. I think you need to go get it right in your face. Okay, Catherine, those are the top 10. Now, you can't tell me to shut up yet because I have a few that I think are must-dos that are not like places to visit.
I didn't
visit.
Say anything.
Yeah, no, but you've already told me, you know how long we've already gone over, blah, blah, blah. Okay. The Shin to ride the bullet train or the Shinkansen. I mean, if you go anywhere outside of Tokyo, you have to treat yourself to that. And don't even think about flying from Tokyo to Kyoto or to Hiroshima. Don't fly. Interior of Japan, just take that wonderful bullet train. You won't have to go to the airport early, fight traffic, anything. You can usually get to all the train stations from subways or taking the taxi and the trains. I mean, they leave on the second and they get where they're supposed to on the second that they're supposed to arrive. They're clean. They're fast. They're luxurious if you go first class. This is something else. And this just shows you how fabulous Japan is. They are efficient, quality. I mean, you can trust you'll be there when you're supposed to. It just is flawless. So don't go into the rigmarole of the airport unless you're leaving Japan or you're entering Japan. So that's one thing that's a must do. The second thing is to take a food tour. I think that's a must do too, because you want to know all these interesting things about, you know, Japan and their cuisine and why rice and fish are always served. They try to do something from the land and the sea in every meal. And all of the secrets on why the Japanese live so long and they never age and they're not overweight. They don't take meds. You don't hardly see a drugstore anywhere. And it lies in the wonderful how they eat and in the food that they eat and their cuisine. So take a food tour so you can understand a lot more, because you'll miss it. You don't know. You'll just be eating and say, oh, this is delicious. And the last thing is, if you can time your visit to either go in cherry blossom season, which I did, and I only did out of dumb luck. I mean, I knew I was going to be there kind of when they should bloom, but I really was blessed by the travel gods. I got there at the very beginning of the season, which was kind of in the third week of March, and left before April 10th. I went through when it started, its highlight, and when it the blossoms were on the street, because it's very short, and they just... all of a sudden, you see them, and then they pop out, and then they all just float down to the ground. But it is spectacular, and the Japanese just go into another state. Like, they go into another dimension. They get so excited, and they're celebrating everywhere, having picnics, taking photographs, being happy. I mean, it's a wonderful time to be in Japan. Besides, it's very beautiful. Then in fall, also, they say that the changing of the colors of the leaves in the Japanese garden and in the mountains is just like, woo, gorgeous. So those are my three little other tips that that are not specifically places. So, Catherine, you know, I'll stop now. But, you know, there's so much to explore and experience in Japan. The culture, I know you've gotten my drift, is very rich with tradition. The architecture is so distinctive. And one of the things I really was amazed is I thought it would be more similar to China and Asia. It's not. It has its own twist. Food, like I said, beyond fabulous, great. So many interesting museums. That was another thing that kind of blew my mind. These great museums. I mean, not that I think that Japan doesn't have aesthetics, but I always think of them with the screens and the, you know, the rolled kind of, what do you call those? The scroll-like things. And they're very simplistic.
The calligraphy.
All of that. But there's much more there that you will only find once you get there. Like, there's this digital museum now that I didn't have a chance to go to in Tokyo, and I know it should be on this list, but I didn't make it there. It is supposed to be out of this world interactive. I mean, it's like it transposes you holographically into all of these. But, I mean, the Japanese are so, they're so brilliant. They really are. So there's lots of museums of all types. The nature, as you've probably got my drift, and the gardens are spectacular because they put so much effort and emphasis on nature and its healing power and its relationship to their spiritual beliefs and the power of life. It is really as good as it gets, in my opinion. But then the people, oh my God, the people are so generous and warm, helpful, kind. If you look like a lost goose, you won't stay there by yourself long, because somebody will come up and try to help you. They're just that way. And they don't do it just for tourists or people, foreigners. They do it for each other, because they're very communally, they think in terms of community. rather than individual. It's just a part of their whole psyche. Mm-hmm. And it makes it so wonderful because you don't feel like, oh my God, you know, I'm lost or, you know, now what? Mm-hmm. You won't feel like that for very long because somebody will try to help you. Okay, so, you know, I kind of end with saying this trip was really one of the best solo adventures I've ever taken in my 45-plus years of solo travel. And I must say, I was shocked. I thought I would like it, but not like I liked it. And I think that the time I spent there affected me on a very deep level. I was so blown away about the quality and simplicity of everything about Japan. It's in everything, the food, the architecture, the fashion, but it's so refined and it makes you kind of more serene. There's something in just the consciousness there, and it goes through everything. The people are so honest and respectful. And, you know, you see that all over. And in a highly developed economy, a super progressive, I guess you'd say, again, economy, people who really want to achieve and focused on excellence, for them to be so honest. And I mean, I can't imagine doing business with a dishonest person in Japan, because to be dishonest is so shameful. And that is one of the big things. They do not ever want to shame themselves, because that's the end. It's the end of everything good in their life, and it's bad for their family, etc. And so that really inspired me myself that, you know, there's hope for the individual, me, you know, hard-driving beliefs in the world and economies, etc. You don't have to be like that, and you still can do great business, because they were. I mean, So it was very inspiring to me, and it kind of wanted to make me a lot more humble and content and reflective. I mean, I didn't realize how non-humble I was or non-content. I didn't see it till I went there. I mean, it kind of helped me pull back some of the layers or the facades that I even had created in myself. And I pride myself in being a truth seeker. But there's something about Japan that really got me. It changed me, and it changed me for the better. So that's kind of how I want to end this show of the 10 most do's. I would say a lot of people end up having similar experiences when they go to Japan. It does affect them, and they do change. So I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today to our third podcast on our Japan series. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard or you benefited from it, give us a thumbs up or share. You know, that's all good with YouTube and all these other people that we're connected to in cyberspace. That's how, you know, we get pushed out more, basically. And likewise, if you have a comment, you know, or if you have a question about Japan, or maybe some must do that I left out that you really think I should, or just any question or whatever about solo travel, feel free to comment in the comment section. We love the comments because it helps us with our programming. It really does. And finally, and I don't want to say the most important thing, but it almost kind of is subscribe to Solo Travel Talk, because that is how the different platforms that we're on determine how much they can push us out to, you know, we're international, to the international audience. And when it gets pushed out, more people listen to it, they benefit from it, and it grows exponentially. So we really do appreciate anybody subscribe. So with that, sayonara.
Listeners, we really hope that you benefited from this program in the Japan series. We started from the majestic, we ended with the poignant, and I thank Astrid for all of her insight into her trip to Japan, so that if we are going to Japan, we can already set our top 10 to do there. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. We love Spotify. Any fine place that you can get your podcast. You can also go to solotraveltalk.com/podcast and get every episode, including everything in the Japan series, plus all the entire catalog of all the episodes that came before. Don't forget, while you're at astridtravel.com, hit the tour button and you can see everything about Astrid's travel club. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We will see you next time on the episode of the Japan series of Solo Travel Talk.
Find Astrid on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. All things Astrid, including the Astrid Travel Club and this podcast, are available at astridtravel.com. Thank you for listening to Solo Travel Talk.